Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Andrea, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is titled Understanding the Role of Immuno-Oncology in Treating Cancer, and this is part one of a two-part series on immuno-oncology as a promising new approach to treating cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And actually, because of the topic, because I know that's a great area of interest for many of you, it's a new area that many of you are hearing about, and because of all of our collaborative organizations and your interest in the topic, we have over 697 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Serbia, Thailand, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's really a credit to all of you that you're going to be on the call with us for the next hour, and that indeed this is a bit of a global call. People from all over the world are on this call. Now, today's program was supported by AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for supporting today's program and this two-part series, as well as their corporate partnership in making this program and sponsorship in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Alan Bryce, and Dr. Bryce is Vice Chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Director, Genomic Oncology Service, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Bryce is going to address an overview of immuno-oncology, harnessing the immune system and treating cancer, and the emerging role of immuno-oncology, including cancer vaccines. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bryce.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being on the call. I'm going to try to lay the groundwork for how immunotherapy or the immune system is used in the care of cancer patients, why that makes sense in a hopefully a systematic manner, and talk about what are the barriers, what is the science behind what we're trying to do with the immune system. In a very general sense, the concept of using the immune system as a treatment modality in cancer is very attractive. In normal health, the immune system acts by recognizing when there are foreign organisms in your body, whether it's bacteria, a virus, something harmful, and the immune system has the ability to recognize these things as being foreign, as not belonging in the body, and thus activating a cascade of events that brings immune cells to the area to then clear out that infection, as it were. Unfortunately, the immune system can also be harmful if it's overactive. And so the immune system has the ability to attack healthy organs, and this is, for example, what underlies things like rheumatoid arthritis, where the immune system is attacking the joints, or diseases like lupus or Crohn's disease or any of the other what we call autoimmune diseases where the immune system is attacking the healthy patient. And so the immune system has built into it a series of checks and balances in order to keep it at the appropriate level of activation without being too active, and also making sure that the immune system is able to respond when needed. And that is really an incredibly elegant but complex system, and it really therein lies the key to why and how the immune system can have a role in the treatment of cancer. So, theoretically speaking, it seems intuitive that a cancer is foreign to the body and the immune system should be able to attack it. The immune system should be able to recognize that the cancer doesn't belong, and through normal mechanisms, clear out that cancer. And indeed, that probably is always happening, that cells will mutate, that they will become unhealthy and head down this path towards becoming a cancerous process, and that as this process happens in our body, perhaps theoretically on a daily basis, the immune system is able to get rid of most of those cells. Unfortunately, by definition, if a cancer establishes itself, if we're able to detect that a patient has cancer, that necessarily means that cancer has found a way to avoid the immune system. And it can do this by a number of different mechanisms. First is the simple fact that by definition, a cancer is derived from the patient's own healthy cells. So in fact, despite the fact that you might think of it as being very different, it's probably 99% identical to every other cell in the body, which is to say that the differences between a cancer cell and a healthy cell are in fact very small. They're key, they're dramatic, but they're very small. And so the immune system has to be able to exploit very narrow differences to identify healthy versus cancerous cells that need to be attacked. And then there's the fact that many cancers have learned to exploit the breaks that are built into the immune system. So as I was describing earlier, the immune system has checks and balances so to keep it from being overactive. And what many cancers have learned to do is to turn on the brakes to stop the immune system. So not only are they able to evade the immune system because they look much like the healthy cell, but they're also then able to stop the immune system if and once it becomes active. And so the checks and balances end up working against the patient and allow the tumor to establish itself. And so the second step then is immune evasion. And the third step then is that this evasive cancer becomes increasingly aggressive as it survives, as it propagates, as it spins off next generations of cells. And through a process of evolution, the tumor becomes increasingly resilient and thus invasive and thus able to spread. And that's what we would think of as tumor escape, kind of the third phase of the interplay between the immune system and the cancer, and the phase that allows the cancer to then establish itself and become a clinically significant problem. So the question for us is, how do we reestablish control? And this is really the wonderful story of the last several years of oncology that Dr. Drilon will go into in greater detail about how immuno-oncology offers new cancer treatment options. You know, the truth of the matter is that the research into immuno-oncology has been going on for over 100 years. Indeed, in a sense, the establishment of Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital back in the late 1800s was based upon early attempts to use immuno-oncology to attack cancer. But in fact, the first drug to show a benefit in cancer control in immuno-oncology was really only approved in 2010. And the only exception to that we can argue about a little bit is if we think about allogeneic stem cell transplants in some leukemias and lymphomas. In a sense, that's immuno-oncology, but really very different from what the new drugs are doing to transform cancer care. And so what these new drugs do is they reassert control over the tumor by, in fact, disabling the blocking mechanisms that the tumors are using. So as I was saying earlier, the cancers have learned how to turn off the immune system and keep the immune system from establishing a response. And so now what we've developed is a series of drugs, and there's more on the way, that turn off the defenses or block the blockers, if you will, to then reallow the immune system to recognize the cancer and start attacking. This removal of inhibition is the basis of establishing a response. And as with any bacteria, any infection, once the immune system is able to establish itself, then it's able to propagate and become increasingly robust. Now, the next generation, the last thing I want to speak to in the last couple minutes is, can we further enhance that immune response by using cancer vaccines? And this is something here again where it's a very attractive narrative, a very attractive possibility to say, can we just give vaccines that protect people against cancer? And I think that's a familiar hypothesis. We do this with bacteria. We do this with infections. we do this with viruses, why can't we do it with cancer? And this gets to the points I've touched on earlier. I mean, there are two issues. One is the cancer is still very much like human cells, so the differences between them are quite narrow. And two is even if you give a vaccine, that doesn't help overcome the resistance mechanisms that the tumor is able to establish, the blockers the tumor is able to establish. So what's happened in the last several years is much like immuno-oncology, vaccine therapies have been attempted and researched for generations now. And I would say in all fairness that it hasn't quite had the transformational moment yet the way immunotherapy has. But what we see is that cancer vaccines can be effective at least in the early pre-malignant lesions. So, for example, the pre-cancerous lesions seen in cervical cancer we know can respond to HPV vaccines, that they can regress if you give a vaccine. But what we haven't yet seen is that metastatic cancers can respond to a vaccine, where what we're doing is we're taking what we believe to be the proteins that are specific to the cancer and injecting them into the patient with the hopes that an immune response will develop against that protein. And if an immune response can develop against the vaccine protein, then that immune response can then spread to go attack the cancer. That's a very, you know, very elegant concept, a very simple concept. Unfortunately, it's also a very difficult concept. And what we believe at this time is that combining vaccines with immunotherapy is probably the most promising strategy, and that's where research is currently going. We certainly hope that what we can do is figure out a way to, if you will, prime the pump by flooding the system with vaccines with the appropriate protein, giving the patient immunotherapy at the same time, and thus increasing synergistically the impact of the immunotherapy. So I'm going to stop there. I know there's many questions, and I want to leave time for questions and also time for Dr. Drilon.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Price. That was really very excellent and elegant and just really very outstanding in terms of just the information and how you explained it. So because I realize these are very complicated concepts people understand, and you certainly made them very understandable. So I know there were questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Alexander Drilon, and Dr. Drilon is Assistant Attending Physician, Thoracic Oncology Service and Developmental Therapeutics, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Drilon is going to address how immuno-oncology offers new treatment options, clinical trial updates, how research contributes to your treatment options, and examples of immunotherapy in prevention, treatment, and recurrence prevention of cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Drilon.
Thanks, Carolyn. And before I begin, I'd like to thank Dr. Bryce as well for an excellent summary of how we think about immune therapy and the concepts or the science behind immuno-oncology. And really, as cancer research moves forward, it's very exciting to see the number of options that we have to battle cancer continue to grow. And to me, this brings up the first concept which I wanted to speak about, which is the concept of personalized medicine and what that means in the context of immune therapy. So in my mind, personalized medicine can really be summarized as the art of picking the best therapy for an individual at a particular point in time. And in clinic, when I explain this to patients and I explain how I make this decision of picking the best therapy, I always say that there are three major groups of systemic therapy or treatment that goes everywhere in the body that can be used for patients with advanced or stage 4 cancers. So these three groups are chemotherapy, targeted therapy, and immune therapy that we're talking about today. And it's important to highlight that while all three types of therapy can be effective for cancer patients in general, for the individual patient, some treatments are likely to work better than others, and we'll explain that a little bit. So my background is I'm a lung cancer doctor, and I also work in the phase one clinic, so early development of drugs for cancer patients. I'm going to pull a little bit from my experience in the field. So in the lung cancer world, some patients, for example, are a much better fit for targeted therapy. And these include patients who, for example, maybe never smokers or had a very minimal history of smoking, whose cancers harbor a particular target. Ergo, if the target is present, then targeted therapy is likely to work. And these targets include gene changes that you may have heard about, like mutations in EGFR, or certain fusions or rearrangements involving ALK. Now, in contrast, there we do see other patients who are probably a much better fit for immune therapy. And again, in the lung cancer world, this includes patients who may have a more substantial history of smoking or whose cancers might have a different type of driver mutation called KRAS. And what we're seeing in the clinic is that these populations aren't generally overlapping. So what I'm trying to say is that some patients who are a better fit for targeted therapy may not respond as well to single-agent immune therapy and vice versa. So that really underscores the fact that in terms of precision medicine or personalized medicine, it's important to work with your doctor, your care providers, to figure out what treatment is best for you and whether that be immune therapy, targeted therapy, or chemotherapy is a complex decision and is based on a number of different factors. But today we'll zoom in on immune therapy and how that's become really beneficial for many patients. And that allows us to segue into a brief description of the different types of immune therapy that are available to us. Dr. Bryce already talked about the general framework of how these drugs were developed, and to me, a lot of the treatments that are available to us can really be simplified by thinking about the model of sort of thinking about yourself being in a car. So if you can imagine, you're sitting in the driver's seat, there's a steering wheel that directs you to where you're going, and obviously the gas pedal to move you forward, and the brakes to stop the car. So essentially what we want to do with immune therapy is to move the car forward, and by doing that, we're allowing the immune system to do its job and attack cancer cells that should be seen as foreign, or should be seen as elements that we need to get rid of. And so these different treatments that we have can do one of three different things. Dr. Bryce had mentioned the vaccine-type therapies that are currently in development. So those can be akin to the steering wheel of the car, where these vaccines are able to direct the immune system to the appropriate direction, meaning direct it to kill cancer cells very specifically the way they should be killing these cancer cells. And there are other agents that, in contrast, work by taking the foot of the driver off of the brakes. Again, Dr. Bryce alluded to this, and many of these are antibodies that inhibit a negative interaction that causes the immune system to shut down. So by taking your foot off the brake and inhibiting that negative interaction, again, the immune system is able to then act and kill the cancer the way it should. And then the last group, really, are antibodies that work by pushing on the gas pedal or moving the car forward. So these are antibodies that stimulate positive interactions that keep these T cells or keep the immune system turned on. And we'll talk today about the most common immune therapies that are antibodies that are currently approved for melanomas, lung cancers, and kidney cancers. So as many of you may know, these are called ipilimumab, nivolumab, and pembrolizumab. And they essentially act by keeping that on switch on. We know that they're able to help patients by doing two things. In a subset of patients, they're able to result in substantial shrinkage of the cancer, and by doing so, are able to improve patient symptoms and quality of life. But I think more importantly, these drugs are, in addition to being able to shrink the cancer, also able to substantially prolong a patient's survival or life, which to us in the clinic is really a much more valuable endpoint. And I think that this is where immune therapy has had a very dramatic impact on the field. Pulling from, again, personal experience, we have patients that are on these immune treatments for a year, 2 years, 3 years in rare cases. And these are patients where we're able to achieve a very durable amount of disease control, or very long-term control of the cancer. And the theory behind why that happens is really it's possible for these drugs to turn on the immune system so effectively that the immune system is then able to adapt to the cancer that's trying to develop resistance at every turn and meet those challenges. So this brings us back to a few of the challenges that we've had to meet in the clinic with regards to administering these immune therapies. The first big question we get asked is, how do you pick the appropriate patients for immune therapy? And you may have heard about looking at certain proteins on a tumor called PD-L1. If you imagine a cancer cell having different proteins on the cell surface, the PD-L1 protein is really a protein that results in, when it binds to a receptor on the T cell called PD-1, it shuts off the T cell and it prevents the immune system from killing the cancer. So what these antibodies do, nivolumab and pembrolizumab, is they interfere with that interaction and keep the immune system turned on, as we spoke about. So then it makes sense to look at whether or not the actual presence of the protein can tell us if somebody is more likely or less likely to respond to therapy. And to bring up an example, pembrolizumab is a drug that was approved for lung cancer in patients that had the presence of that protein called PD-L1 on the surface of the cells, while the other drug, nivolumab, was approved for patients with non-small cell lung cancers regardless of the presence of PD-L1. So the next question is it something that's useful to us? And certainly we see that patients whose cancers have PD-L1 on the cell surface, there are hints of these patients being much more poised to have better shrinkage of the cancer or to have more of a benefit in terms of survival. But in my personal practice, I've come to realize that there are patients who respond to these immune therapies regardless of the presence of the PD-L1 protein. And in simple terms, there are patients whose cancers we do a biopsy of and don't find the PD-L1 protein, but still respond to immune therapy. So personally, I don't discriminate when I give these drugs in clinic because both patients with the protein and without the protein do stand to benefit from therapy. There are other things which you may have heard of also, which we call biomarkers or features of the cancer that help us predict whether or not it's more likely to respond to immune therapy. And some of these things include how complex the cancer is. And I'm speaking about the fact that some cancers can harbor lots of mutations inside the tumor, and because of that can be much more visible to the immune system. You may have heard that in colon cancers, there's a certain group of colon cancers that aren't very good at repairing defects in DNA in the tumor cells, and because of this harbor lots of mutations, and these cancers in a clinical trial of pembrolizumab seem to be much more likely to respond to therapy than cancers that weren't deficient in that repair pathway, which is called the mismatch repair pathway. We've also seen a similar signal in lung cancer, where cancers which harbor many more mutations are much more poised to respond. So it remains to be seen whether or not this is something that will help us make the best decision in clinic. Moving on to a few other challenges that we meet with giving immune therapy in the clinic, the second major issue we've had to deal with is the fact that response to these therapies, when we do CAT scans to see if the treatment is working, are sometimes difficult to interpret. If you imagine the immune therapies working by drawing the immune system to the cancer cells so that the T cells can then effectively kill the cancer, you can imagine that some of these cancers can look chunkier with both the tumor cells and the T cells mixed in. And so if you do a scan while someone's on therapy with a bigger burden of the immune system trying to kill off the cancer, often they can look bigger on scans, and that's what we call the flare phenomenon. And in those patients, the cancer, the flare phenomenon truly is responsible for the cancer is looking worse on the first scan. Subsequent scans will then show that the cancer continues, now starts to shrink with therapy. So the way I deal with this in clinic is that when somebody is on immune therapy and has very clear benefits in terms of symptoms, meaning they have cancer symptoms like pain that have improved with treatment, and they're tolerating therapy well, if the first scan shows a hint of cancer growth, I will continue immune therapy through till the next scan. In contrast, in patients who aren't doing so well with immune therapy or that have very clearly progressive cancer or worsening symptoms from their cancer, if their first scan shows that the cancer is growing, my bias will be to take those patients off. And the last issue I wanted to discuss relates to the side effects of these therapies. So overall, these immune therapies can be, in some cases, more tolerable than chemotherapy. But it's important to recognize that there are some rare side effects. So by rare, I mean a side effect that you might see in one out of every 100 patients that we treat, where the immune system is turned on so effectively that it starts to attack not just the cancer itself, but it starts to also attack and cause inflammation in non-cancer tissues. Certain types of these inflammatory reactions, to name a few, include inflammation of the lung, inflammation of the bowels, inflammation of other normal tissues like the liver or the skin, for example, that can be managed by stopping the immune drug and giving steroids. But interestingly, in many of the patients that we've treated with immune therapy, because the immune system is turned on so effectively, even though we stop treatment with the immune therapeutic, a lot of these patients on scans done even after they're off immune therapy will continue to show control of their cancer, even though they're technically off treatment. A few other things we pay attention to are so-called changes in the endocrine system. So some patients can develop inflammation of glands that produce particular hormones in the body, like the thyroid, for example, and that can cause symptoms like fatigue. We've, as oncologists, had to really be very keen about talking to a patient and figuring out whether or not their symptoms are a result of the immune therapeutic itself and the fact that the drug is poised to cause inflammation or these autoimmune manifestations. I'm going to end there and allow time for questions. Really, I think the takeaway from my piece and Dr. Bryce's piece is that we're very excited about these therapies. They can result in very dramatic and substantial benefits for patients. We tried to describe a little bit of in terms of the challenges that we face in the clinic, we'll go back to Carolyn to introduce Glenn for the next session and answer questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Trelawney. That was really outstanding and also very understandable, making very complex concepts understandable to everyone on the call. So I really thank you for that. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. So really just outstanding. Thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Glenn Nuce. And Amitriche is an oncology social worker, and he is our social work internship program coordinator at Cancer Care. And he will be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Amitriche.
Thank you, Carolyn. I would also like to thank everyone who participated in today's Cancer Care's Connect Education Workshop. In closing, I would like to speak briefly about the services that Cancer Care provides. Living with cancer can present a variety of challenges, which may feel overwhelming at times and impact your quality of life. You may discover yourself faced with many questions surrounding your illness and the decisions that have to be made in terms of your treatment and care. You may find it exceedingly difficult to navigate the complexity of the healthcare system and network. Sometimes you may not even know where to begin or who to ask for support. You are not alone, however, and help is available. It is important to remember that treatment and care is most effective when understood within the framework and context of teamwork. Recognize that it is your right to have a good healthcare team who listens to your questions and concerns. Get to know all the members of your medical team and learn how each person can help you. A Cancer Care social worker can help you sort through the myriad of issues that may surround your cancer diagnosis and treatment. An oncology social worker can address any concerns you may harbor pertaining to your quality of life during this period. Social workers can offer tips and suggestions, for instance, that would help you open doors and effectively communicate your needs to the health medical team as it relates to your care. Cancer Care social workers can also direct you to additional supportive resources that may help foster your continued ability to cope with your cancer experience. The emotional component in face of a cancer diagnosis can frequently leave us feeling confused and experiencing a wide range of feelings. I cannot underestimate, therefore, the significance of individual counseling and support groups. Cancer Care offers free individual counseling and support by professional oncology social workers who can walk with you and provide a listening ear. Individual counseling and support, either on the telephone or face-to-face, will afford you an opportunity to talk about your feelings and process what you may be experiencing. Through individual counseling and support, you will ensure your continued capacity to cope and may perhaps even learn new coping strategies to help you adjust to the many twists and turns of the cancer experience. The social interaction offered by support groups can help diminish feelings of isolation and strengthen our ability to cope. Support groups provide a safe and supportive environment where we not only can share our story and experiences with others, but learn from those who may be experiencing similar feelings, fears, and concerns as well. Support groups offer us a space where we can speak about our diagnosis, care, and the array of emotions we may be experiencing at this time. In Cancer Care's online, telephone, and face-to-face support groups, people can receive emotional support, insight, and camaraderie. Cancer Care support groups are offered to patients, family members, and friends, caregivers, survivors, and the bereaved. And last, the cancer care diagnosis can present an economic and financial burden at times as well. Financial assistance is available at Cancer Care. Cancer Care can help reduce the expenses associated with transportation to and from treatment, home care, child care, and in some instances for pain medication related to a person's cancer, treatment, and care. In addition to this, a Cancer Care social worker can direct you to other resources in your community that may offer financial assistance. So I'll conclude here. Thank you again, Carolyn, for having me on this call.
Oh, thank you so much, Glenn. That was really outstanding, and thank you so much for really making these services so clear to everybody in terms of how they can access them from cancer care. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Andrea to bring all of our speakers on board. And I'm going to also ask Andrea to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And indeed, if we do not get to your question, please note I will explain to all of you how to get all your questions answered before the call ends. But let's see how many of your questions we can take just right now. So, Andrea?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from the line of Stephanie Kay. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much. This is an excellent seminar. Excellent. Thank you so much, Glenn, also. I am a 9-year breast cancer survivor, and I had HER2 positive and ER negative, PR negative. And my question is, the PD-1 protein on the cells, is this similar to HER2 breast cancer that's the protein on the cells also? Because we used Adriamycin on my cancer and Cytoxan and Taxol and Herceptin for a year and 2 months. My question is, can you use this vaccine similar with the HER2? Can it be used by itself? Can it be used with the chemo, like you said, and also post-treatment, prevention of reoccurrence of breast cancer? And number two, can you use this with prostate cancer, with prevention or post-reoccurrence? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. Those are wonderful questions. You know, we do have a program coming up only on breast cancer, actually, in May. And I know you get all of our material, so that's a great question also to pose there. And I'm going to ask Dr. Bryce and Dr. Drouin to just address your question in a general way, because, again, it's very specific to your type of cancer, and, of course, your healthcare team is a wonderful resource as well. But I'm going to ask if our speakers can address this just in a general way, because I realize as people hear this concept, all of you make connections to your own treatment. So, Dr. Bryce, would you address this in a general way to begin with?
Yeah. So, yes, I certainly understand the question and kind of how you're coming about it. What you're getting at is the point of, we know that there's various proteins that get identified for cancers. Breast cancer, we talk about HER2, of course, ER and PR as well. Other cancers have other key proteins that we attack. So what the essence of the question gets to is what is a particular protein doing? Because that really gets to how we might attack different proteins in different ways. So in the example of HER2 positive breast cancer, what's happening there is that there is a receptor on the surface of the cell that actually is stimulating the growth signal of the cell. So the breast cancer is growing because HER2 is sending the growth signal down through a series of a pathway through the cell, if you will. And so what happens is we specifically try to inhibit the growth signal by introducing an antibody that will block the HER2 protein. In the case of immunotherapy, as we're talking about with PD-1 or PD-L1, rather than blocking a stimulatory signal, what we're trying to do is prevent an inhibitory signal. We actually want to turn on the immune pathway, whereas in breast cancer, we're trying to turn off the HER2 pathway. And I mean, there's some details we can get into about different ways to do that, but it is analogous in the sense that in both cases, what we're trying to do is go after cell signaling that is initiated from the cell surface, so that antibodies that then coat the surface of the cell can modify that signaling in the direction that we want.
Thank you. And Dr. Drouin, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, so very quickly, the first thing I wanted to add is that it's a great question related to these different proteins that are on the surface of cancer cells. But to put it very simply, HER2 helps us pick the best targeted therapy for a particular patient, while PD-L1 helps us pick potentially the best immune therapy for a patient. And the second thing I wanted to add, which the question reminded me, was that these immune therapies, while I talked specifically about lung cancer, melanoma, and kidney cancer, are available to breast cancer patients and patients with different types of cancer on clinical trials.
Thank you. And Glenn, do you want to comment on this? Because people are often making connections, I know, in our groups, like if this is available for this, is it available for that? Could you just comment in general about just trying to figure things out and how really quite, I think, thoughtful many of our participants are and trying to figure things out in terms of how something new can be applied to them.
Well, you know, I'm via support groups and working in individual counseling. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, it's always important to do your research and do your homework, but it can be helpful also to, you know, write things down and to, you know, gather any concerns, any questions surrounding your treatment and care. And sometimes reaching out to peer resources where, you know, you can isolate an individual who perhaps is experiencing a similar diagnosis or who harbors similar concerns can be helpful.
Thank you. Okay. Great question. Thanks for starting this off. And we have a question from one of our online participants. And I'm going to ask actually both Dr. Bryce first and then Dr. Vidralon to address this one. It's a general question. How far are we from seeing kinase inhibitors to replace chemotherapy? So it's a general question. If you could address this in a general way and also explain to the audience about this participant knows what kinase inhibitors are, but if one may not. So if you could just explain that as well. Dr. Bryce?
Yeah, so a kinase inhibitor is a fairly specific term talking about another mechanism by which we can inhibit a protein. Not truly dissimilar to what we talk about with antibodies, it's just hitting different parts of the protein, different ways to design molecules to try to accomplish the same end. At the end of the day, what we're talking about one way or the other is either turning off or turning on pathways and reprogramming the cell to act in the way we want it to act. One of the difficulties with the question is that, you know, chemotherapy in a strictly scientific sense is not a technical term. It's not a scientific term. It's a colloquial term that's used to describe drugs that we use in cancer. And so what often happens is that people try to avoid the term chemotherapy and relabel new therapies as something else simply because chemotherapy has become something of a dirty word in some people's mind. You know, avoid chemo as much as possible. And yet the truth of the matter is that many kinase inhibitors is just as toxic as chemotherapy, just as impactful on quality of life. So I say this to make the point, in my mind, we're not trying to replace chemotherapy. What we're trying to do is come up with the most effective therapies possible that have the lowest side effects, and whether that would fall into what one might consider chemotherapy or kinase inhibitors or immunotherapy, it's not the class that matters. It's the impact that matters. So are we about to replace traditional chemotherapy that we've lived with for the past few generations? We're making progress on that year over year. I do think therapies are getting less toxic and more effective, and these are equally important goals. So yes, we're making progress, but is there a watershed moment imminent where, you know, all of our familiar drugs that we've had for the past 30 years are about to be set aside? No, I don't think that's imminent.
Thank you. And Dr. Jalan, did you want to add anything?
So I agree. There's absolutely a role for both treatments. We know that, unfortunately, despite the development of many very exciting therapies, including targeted therapy, cancer does learn to outsmart what we throw at it after a period of time. And while for some patients these kinase inhibitors can work very well up front, you will need something to switch a particular patient to when that time comes. And so it's all about having as many active agents as possible to stack longitudinally to try to control the an individual's cancer for as long as possible. So I don't think chemo is going away in the near future. And as Dr. Bryce mentioned, it can be very effective.
Excellent. Thank you both. That's really wonderful. Excellent. Very clear and, again, very helpful. And our next question, Andrea, from our telephone audience.
Yes, we have a question from the line of Randy J. Your line is open.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, Dr. Drillin and Dr. Bryce, for a great lecture. My question is, how common is it in the process of diagnosing cancer? Is it the standard of care for most patients that are diagnosed today to have their tumor tested for these molecular or genetic alterations such as the EGFR or CRAS, depending upon the type of cancer diagnosed? Are we seeing that being done pretty much at most cancer centers these days?
Really excellent question, and really the question of the day. So I'm going to ask Dr. Drillin if he would address it first, and then Dr. Bryce, but I think that's really an important question. Dr. Drillin?
Yeah, for lung cancer, molecular profiling or molecular testing to look for these mutations is standard of care. And we know that's because if you find the appropriate target, you're then able to give the patient the appropriate targeted therapy, and many of them are approved by the FDA. This paradigm has started to carry over to other types of cancers. So in our institution, we're trying to not be biased in terms of who we get the molecular testing. And if it's possible to do molecular profiling for a patient regardless of their tumor, we do it. If you're asking about the other protein we were talking about, PD-L1, that hasn't in general become something that is done across the board, and that goes back to what I mentioned earlier, the fact that patients respond to immune therapy whether or not they have the protein. So at least here in our lung cancer service, many of my colleagues have not routinely tested for PD-L1, but molecular testing is something that everyone does across the board.
And Dr. Bryce, do you want to add any?
No, I'd agree with that. That's right.
And I guess the other thing would be, it's a question also for everyone, do you think, to ask their healthcare team, because everyone on the call has different types of cancers, and just is it a fair question just to ask if this is something that's available for their particular type of cancer? Would you recommend that, Dr. Bryce, or is that something that we're people, just because they're getting information now about this, that they would want to just pose the question? Is that something that...
I think that's right. I mean, the concept of molecular testing of cancers, this isn't new. I mean, this is something we've been doing in some form or another for, you know, decades now. The extent to which it's being discussed, I think, in more public discourse has changed simply because the technology has changed. But in a lot of ways, I think of this as nothing more than a continuation of, you know, actually centuries-long process of getting more and more precise in how we define disease. And as new technologies come on board and we're able to subset disease into more specific categories, you know, we keep pushing that boundary as far as we can. So, absolutely, I agree. I think this is standard of care, and for every particular cancer, there are different tests we might order, because the tests you want for breast cancer aren't going to be the same as the tests you want for leukemia, for example. I absolutely think that this is kind of a normal process. It's worthwhile asking your treating physician about, you know, what are the markers you think about for my cancer? What tests are appropriate for this cancer? And they can provide you with some explanation about what are really the key components to talk about your particular situation.
And we have a question also from one of our online participants. do vaccines affect immuno-oncology?
So I think actually Dr. Drillin's analogy works fairly well in terms of thinking of vaccine as being a steering wheel. That is, you know, it's a way of trying to direct the immune system in a certain direction to attack a certain part of whatever is going on in the body. It's a nice concept simply because it's very easy to grasp, right? You have, you know, the cancer cell, just say it's blue, whereas the body is red or purple or whatever. And, you know, it's got some characteristic you can exploit. So if you tell the immune system, go after that X, then it will. And that's the concept behind vaccines. The trick is the fact that I guess it's easier said than done, I guess is the point is, you know, we don't have a vaccine for the common cold, right? And it's the same concept with cancer is, you know, unfortunately there's a lot of diversity, and it's not as simple as just saying, well, as long as you can define what a cancer looks like, therefore you can mount an immune response. Unfortunately, the body's much more clever than that. You know, it really comes down to the impact of evolution, the impact of how does the body protect itself against an overactive immune system. The immune system is held in check intentionally, because when it's not in check, it will be harmful. So the balance is the trick, really exploiting very narrow differences between the cancer cell and the human healthy cell is the trick. You know, as much as I'd love to say, yes, we've got the vaccine answer, it's still a very difficult thing to accomplish. You know, as I say, it's the reason we don't have a vaccine for the common cold. It's a trickier problem than that, unfortunately.
Thank you. And Dr. Jawan, did you want to add anything?
Yep. So, vaccines, when they've been used by themselves, historically haven't been very effective. And to emphasize something that Dr. Bryce had mentioned earlier, I think that probably the way to go moving forward is to provide a two-hit punch where you come in with a vaccine that helps direct the immune system to the appropriate target. But in addition to the vaccine, you give another drug, like one of these antibodies, so nivolumab or pembrolizumab, for example, that in addition to directing the immune system, then revs the immune system up so that you're able to deliver a much more effective immune response specifically to the cancer cell. So that's where I see the field going. But right now, vaccines by themselves, when given in isolation as single agents, the results haven't been that fruitful.
Excellent. And there was a question really around hematologic malignancies and immune therapy for Dr. Bryce and Dr. Vaughan probably as well. Is anything happening in both fields in the hematologic malignancies and immune therapy in terms of looking at immune therapy as a type of treatment from Patricia, one of our online participants? Dr. Bryce?
Yeah, absolutely.
In a general way. Yes.
So, you know, the exciting thing about immunotherapy, about these new checkpoint inhibitors that we have approved, is they appear to have broad applicability. So even though it was approved first in melanoma and then in lung cancer, and now we have approvals in kidney cancer, we expect soon in bladder cancer, this also crosses to hematologic malignancies. So Hodgkin lymphoma is a disease where there is now a approval to use immune inhibitors, and trials are ongoing across, you know, nearly the whole spectrum of cancers, both hematologic cancers and solid tumors. And it's quite remarkable, really. So yes, the answer is these absolutely have a role in blood cancers as well. That's proven in Hodgkin's. I certainly expect and hope that we'll see data in more cancers moving forward. It's hard to understate how dramatic this revolution is now that we finally have effective immune modulating agents. you know, not to overstate the case, but I think in a historical sense, you know, this will prove to be one of those inflection points that you know, medical history textbooks will talk about. The development of antibiotics, the development of aseptic technique, of x-rays, of anesthesia, of vaccines. Eventually, we'll talk about the development of immunotherapy, you know, in the 2010s as being really one of those transition points in medical history.
Excellent. Thank you. That's really amazing. And Dr. Drillon, do you want to add as well?
Yeah, I agree. So immune therapy applies to all cancers. And one particular type of immune therapy drug that I didn't have the time to bring up that has been effective in the liquid tumor world. So we say liquid tumors to describe lymphomas or leukemia is the CAR T cell. So this is the chimeric antigen receptor T cell that in very simple terms is sort of a genetically modified T cell that, again, redirected to specifically attack the cancer cell. Give an example of where this can be very effective. A type of leukemia called acute lymphoblastic leukemia we've achieved very good responses with CAR T cell therapy in these patients.
Well, this has been an extraordinary call, and I think I have to say, I want to thank our speakers. You've just all been amazing. This is an extraordinary call. And I also want to thank all of our participants who asked really such great questions that really allowed our speakers to even elaborate further, and all of you who've been listening. And in planning a program like this is a one-hour workshop. We do recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So in terms of wrapping it up, I just want to, for anyone who didn't, there are many questions we didn't get to answer. So for those of you who have more medically-based questions regarding the applicability of immunotherapy to your particular type of cancer or particular trials that might be out there, we recommend that you contact the National Cancer Institute. It's a wonderful place for information specialists. Actually, you're always waiting after our calls to get calls from all of you. And their number is 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And that's included in all of the materials that we've sent to you. In addition, if you have questions where you want to talk with one of our cancer care oncology social workers around their practical or financial assistance, or joining a support group, or getting some counseling, or participating in future programs like this, ordering publication, you can contact our social workers here at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Again, and you can pose your questions there, or again, connect with one of our social workers there. I do want to remind all of you there is a part two to today's program. It's actually on May 10th. Same time, and it's on managing the side effects of immunotherapy. So for those of you on today's program, many of you have already signed up for part two, but just to remind all of you about that program. And again, I want to thank you all for participating today. I also want to remind you all that you're not alone in coping with your cancer. You may feel that way very often or at different times of the day or night. Please now feel you are connected to the cancer care world, and we're here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away or a mouse click away on your in terms of the accessing our website. And do take advantage of these services. They're free and they're available. And again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.